Okay, so today I'm going to talk about some recent work with a whole bunch of people, some as recent as last week, on characterizing the coherence of errors and how this relates to things like the Diamond distance and fidelity that used to estimate or to characterize the performance of systems. So broadly speaking, there are, and feel free to interrupt with questions. Broadly speaking, there are, as you probably all know, two types of errors. There's coherent and incoherent errors. And depending on your perspective, either coherent errors are great and incoherent errors are awful, or the other way around. So yeah, both perspectives are also correct. So the coherent errors essentially arise, or typically arise due to imperfections in controls. So you're applying some sequence of pulses and you get the timing wrong or pulse shape wrong. And so you do some kind of over-rotation, under-rotation, or rotation about the wrong axis. Incoherent or decoherent errors are also essentially unitary, but the difference is they're unitary interactions with an environment that you don't control. So when you average over the state of the environment, you get some stochastic process. So from the there's two main perspectives, which is the first is kind of the experimentalist perspective, which is not me, just getting that part out there, which is that there's all kinds of quantum information tricks that we can do that will be wonderful for humanity when we can do them. But we can't do them yet because our operations aren't good enough and we need to improve them. And from this perspective, unitary errors are the best thing ever because when you have a unitary control error, you can fix it by improving your pulse shaping, improving your timing, calibration, everything like that. If, however, you have stochastic errors, as a lot of groups are starting to get closer to, then you have big problems because if you want to improve things more substantially, then at least at the physical level, then you have to either start controlling more of your environment or throw away your system and start again. And both of these are very expensive options. And so you would rather avoid that. Now, or at least so people tell. Now, from a different perspective, which is that quantum information will be wonderful for humanity, and we don't need perfect operations to do it, we just need things that are good enough. From this perspective, coherent operations are the best thing ever, are the worst thing ever, and stochastic are the best thing ever for a couple of different reasons. Firstly, if you have stochastic errors, they only accumulate linearly with the depth of your circuit. Their effect can be efficiently simulated if you have something like stable Clifford circuits. And generally speaking, they are easier to characterize. Whereas if you have coherent errors, then you can't simulate them efficiently in Clifford circuits. They can accumulate quadratically with the depth of the circuit, and depending on the way you characterize them, they introduce more variability in larger errors.
So you said you can simulate it in something circuit, and
Clifford circuit.
Okay, perfect.
So,
yeah.
Okay. This is all kind of being hand-wavy, so let's get a little more formal. So just to fix some notation, if I have a channel is a map from density matrices of a D-level system, and I can define two particular parameters of interest, which are the infidelity, which is the integral over all pure state psi of trace of psi as a density operator with the identity minus the channel of interest applied to psi. So this is your infidelity. And we have our
this is infidelity with respect to the identity.
Infidelity, average gate infidelity with respect to the identity. I call it infidelity because it's pretty much the only infidelity people really talk about without a name in headline claims. So, if you have a headline claim of so many nines of fidelity, it's always this one. But yeah, there are other ones. Just this is the one that gets the most attention. And then you have the diamond distance from the identity, which I'll call W of E. And this is defined as a maximization over pure states of the difference of the channel from the identity tensored with another identity for good measure applied to pure states. And it's a trace norm. And so this trace norm of an operator is just defined to be the trace, the square root of A dagger A, or equivalently, it's the one norm of the vector of singular values of A. Both of those are equivalent characterizations. So, oh, I forgot to mention, this part of the talk will be covering some material in slightly different ways to Yuval, who has talked to you before. But there's, so the first thing when you see these two things is which quantity should I use? And in a sense, it doesn't matter because these are equivalent quantities in that they bound each other. So for any linear map, we have d plus 1 on d times the infidelity is less than or equal to W of E, which is the worst case error, and that's less than or equal to the square root of d, d plus 1 times the infidelity. So these two things formally define equivalent metrics on the space of channels, which essentially is going to mean that you can, if you have a worst case error of 0, if and only if your infidelity is 0. But this square root scaling here is actually quite a significant difference in the regime that we're actually looking at experimentally. So at the moment, we're looking at things along the lines of, which of these move?
You might need to push something on that screen.
Oh, they're automated now. Okay. Weird. Okay, that can just, okay. Okay, so we have these square root scaling. So the current regime at the moment, we know that the infidelities are something like 10 to the minus 5 in very, very isolated incidences, all the way up to 10 to the minus 3 for single qubit gates. And basically, the state of the art seems for a 2 qubit seems to be 10 to the minus 2, and that's demonstrated in quite a lot of groups now, but they're all, a lot of groups are around 10 to the minus 2, give or take a factor of probably 3 or 4. Now, this is the infidelity. What about the worst case error? Well, that's never really reported, and let me know if my writing gets too messy. These things, the worst case errors on the single qubit gates, they're not actually well understood, but they're probably actually very close to stochastic. So they may actually be at this 10 to the minus 5 to 10 to the minus 3 regime. Maybe. But we know for sure that these things, the 2-qubit gates, are nowhere near that. The best, when you look through the details of a lot of different experiments, you'll see a lot of arguments for why these are stochastic, and then you'll see that something like 50% of the infidelity contribution for the 2-qubit gates is unitary. So some kind of timing problem or over-rotation or coherent noise or collective noise, something, but these things, about 0.1. Again, give or take a factor of two. And, you know, 10% error is pretty huge in terms of worst case. So this is not really actually supporting a lot of the headline claims that get made of it. So which one should we trust if we look at the cube two qubit case? The point, the 10 to the minus 2 or the 10 to the minus 1? One of the things that gets said of the infidelity is that it's an average error and the diamond distance is a worst case error. This is actually a very confusing red herring that, as far as I can understand, originated in the original statement is that the infidelity is the average error in a randomized benchmarking experiment, which is quite different from just saying it's an average error. But you can make this a lot more precise. The difference in scaling between these two quantities is not an average versus worst case distinction. So to convince you of that, I actually prove that in a very quick statement. Let's define the maximum infidelity to be the maximization over all states of the trace of psi with I minus E of psi. This is, and what I'm going to prove is that this is essentially proportional to the average infidelity. So that means this maximum still scales linearly with the average infidelity, and it's not scaling like the square root. So it's more, what this is going to show is that these two quantities are picking up on very different types of errors.
Joel, wouldn't you want to extend this? Like to an ancilla system? Because the channel distinguishability increases.
It's not actually going to make much difference.
Okay.
That will just pick up at worst a dimensional factor.
Okay.
And you'll see why. Well, that's also going to depend a little bit on the extension.
Right.
In
the same way that this is defined as a max over psi of the extended
system.
Yeah.
Sorry. I thought you were talking about dilation for a second. If it's an extension, then it's
the
really not going to change anything.
As the
at all.
Diamond distance is the maximization over the inputs to the.
Yeah, with entangled inputs.
Yeah.
I mean, formally, that would be the most rigorous thing to make sure you're comparing apples and apples. It will add a dimensional factor. But I'll just quickly show why this thing is still linear. So it's order of d squared times the average infidelity. And the proof is extremely quick. So let pi be such let phi be a state that maximizes the infidelity. And some set of states containing phi be a state to design of order d squared. And such state designs always exist. Because I have a state design and my fidelity is linear, instead of evaluating over the integral, I can just evaluate over the sum. And I really should have established some better notation, but that's okay. Okay, so instead of evaluating the expression over integral, integrating it over the pure states, over the Haar measure, I can just evaluate average over the two design. And then I notice that this quantity here is greater than or equal to 1 on S times R max of E. So if I drop every other term but the maximizing state, those are all non-negative. So I've made this right-hand side smaller, which implies that R max of E is less than or equal to the order of S times the average infidelity. And since this is order d squared in general, you can work out the constants fairly easily. But the bigger point is that it's the same order as the average gate infidelity. Now, if it's not a worst case versus average disconnect, what is it? Oh, I can't even see where that one is. Well, the answer turns out to be that, again, these things are just capturing completely different quantities. So the diamond distance, loosely speaking, again, you can work out the constants, they're relatively small, but it's something like the maximum over psi and phi of the trace of phi with I minus E applied to psi. So the difference between these two things is in the fidelity, phi is fixed to psi, which means that what you're talking about is an error in the probability when you measure in the basis of the system, whereas the diamond distance is capturing an error in a probability when your measurement is in a different basis. Now, there are times when you actually want to measure in the basis of your system, and when you're in such a scenario, the right quantity is the fidelity. But in generic quantum computation, for instance, you do not generally get a deterministic answer, which even in the absence of noise, which means you're never actually measuring in the basis of a system. You're measuring in a different basis. And so that means that this quantity is going to be the one that's much more important for quantum computation. There's kind of a couple of other caveats there, but so then the other question is, do we just have bad bounds on the infidelity compared to the diamond distance and the infidelity? Or is this going to actually matter? In practice, we know that we are going to try and improve control till we hit the limit of stochastic noise. Yes?
Joel, is this, in this characterization of the diamond norm, is it psi and phi are on a single system, or are they also extended?
Sorry, they're also extended. The biggest impact, at least in terms of all of the bounds on this, is actually more in terms of the dimensional scaling rather than the square root R scaling, which is why I tend to just forget about it, but I shouldn't. So if you try and do bounds on the thing without the extension, you find they scale as the square root R as well. So again, it's not a question of being stable under tensoring, it's a question of different quantities. And so as I was saying, ultimately the aim will be you improve control until unitary errors are no problem. But there's a little bit of a hiccup there in that there's only so much you can improve unitary errors, and that's probably going to be limited by your stochastic noise anyway. So loosely speaking, you can only improve something if you can see it. So as a particular example to try and show why this is still an important issue, let's consider a composite noise channel. So first depolarizing noise, so depolarizing noise which just reduces the purity of any state, and followed by unitary noise, which is going to just put a phase on one of the basis states, and essentially, because I haven't set any preferred direction, this is kind of an arbitrary single qubit unitary. Okay, now what's going to happen here, or what regime do we want to consider? You can show for this that if I have the channel that's the composition of these things, then the infidelity is roughly this depolarizing parameter V plus theta squared, and just some random constants for fun. They are actually the correct ones, but anyway. And the worst case error ends up being the square root of V squared plus theta squared. Okay, two parameters, that makes my head hurt. I'm pretty bad at that kind of thing, so you know, let's just make it a single parameter. Let's say that we can tune our coherent errors to something like 10% of our fidelity, 10% of our depolarizing parameter, and then beyond that we just struggle because we can't detect that there's an error there anymore. So this is well below anything that, say, some kind of spin echo pulse will pick up. Then what we can say is, in this particular regime, this goes to essentially V on 2, because this term just gets complete, theta squared is completely negligible next to V. But this thing, we now get that V squared is completely, theta squared. We now have this going to 10 to the, square root of 0.1 V. And then in the regime where our fidelities are starting to get good, useful, these two quantities get an incredibly big gap. And as you start doing error correction and trying to reduce your errors, the gaps between these things actually gets bigger. So if you want to make a claim about, I have no more than this error, then depending on the quantity used, that will change the conclusion you make by orders of magnitude.
Do you think error correction treats them differently?
So error correction will reduce both of these, and generically it will actually separate two errors that are close together will get separated quite substantially. So this actually, I'm only treating this in a very cavalier way, but David Poulin has been, when I talked to him in at the ARO meeting in July, he's actually been doing some numerics to see how errors get separated when you do error correction, and he was even finding that if you have the same diamond distance or the same fidelity, they can still get separated by substantial, by up to 10 orders of magnitude.
When you say errors get separated by error correction, you mean the piece which is not corrected by error correction, the leftovers, this is what you
have. Yeah. Yeah, so you get a, you know, on the first level of concatenation, you get a quadratic suppression, for instance, and then as you go
and
further
you look
and further.
What is the shape, type of errors in the quadratic term, and you say it's more separate than what you have.
Yeah.
Do you have an intuition of why is that?
Not a very clear intuition. So my comment here is just that if you have a residual coherent error in your code space after doing error correction, then it's going to have a bigger and bigger effect. That is kind of... as to whether, as to how big a coherent error you should expect to get, I don't actually know. There's kind of things that I can't simulate very well.
And you see, it's generic for all error correction.
All error correction separates errors.
I cannot dream of a part of the code which would treat them the same.
Exactly.
When you say it separates, you mean those two numbers get more different?
Both improve. But the question, so the issue is both improve, but when you're doing error correction, you only do it until your numbers are good enough. You know, you don't want to do it too often. You just correct until you're below some margin of error that you just don't care about anymore. And the question is, when have you reached that margin of error? And you'll get different conclusions based on which number you use here.
But I think acquiring like coherent errors in the code space, again, isn't a bad thing. In the same way that physical errors are not bad. Because if you can say you go to something I've been thinking about like logical state tomography or you know logical randomized benchmarking and things like this, then you can detect these coherent errors and it just means you need to fiddle with your controls a little bit.
Yeah, I would agree. I think this is a regime we haven't really entered yet because no one's got logical
qubits
to play around with. But I would agree, that would be the natural thing to do. But at the same time, before you work out whether you have to do that, you want to something to characterize, do you have a number that says, do I have to worry about this or not? And I'm going to present a number that says, you know, here's the benchmark you do. Here is essentially going to be the thing that you do to tell whether these two numbers are different or not. That will tell you whether you have coherent errors. So this is kind of all the intro, which is still containing stuff that is kind of percolating through the community at the moment. So that's why I spent a bit longer on it. But now I'll move on to, and some of it's still new as well. So now I'm going to move on to, okay, if we have a little bit of coherent error, we can have a problem. We'd like to know how much of a coherent error do we have? How do we quantify it? And so this is actually, historically, I was more interested in this problem before I was interested in any of the error correction, just because I knew that I could already, essentially, I had a result and I needed to motivate it. As I'm sure, you know, no one else in this room has ever done. So I'm actually giving this talk in the reverse, almost the reverse order of the way I went about it in the first place. So to quantify the unitarity, or quantifying the coherence, so I'm going to introduce a parameter I call the unitarity. A new parameter. So this may, depending on the way things work out, this may not be the final iteration of how you quantify coherent noise, but my hope for the rest of the talk is first to define what this thing is, then argue that it is extremely useful or provides very valuable information about noise, and then finally, if I have time, show you that it can be efficiently estimated. The efficient estimation part, if you've got the motivation for the rest of the talk, is all outlined in the paper, so it's, and it's fairly straightforward, so that's why I'm spending more time on the rest of it. But the unitarity, so that there are many different ways you could quantify how coherent noise is. I'm just going to pick one. In order to introduce it, I'm just going to quickly cover representation of channels extremely quickly. So if we have some trace orthonormal basis, our space of density operators. So that means that the inner product, or trace inner product, bj, between bj and bk, is equal to the delta function. So given such a basis, we can expand any state rho as the sum of essentially expansion coefficients in that basis. And this is going to give us d squared numbers, and we can take these and make them into a vector. Which I'll just denote using a modified Dirac notation. And because if I set this basis to be Hermitian, then this vector will always be real, and it will always have d squared numbers. And then if I have quantum channels are linear, which means that I can always express them as a matrix acting on this vector space. So some abstract channel E can go to some concrete matrix, which is defined such that E applied to a vector gives me the vector corresponding to the action of E on that state, on the corresponding state. So that's very, very quick. Okay, this one seems to be a bit different. Now, anytime you start talking about linear algebra, the last thing you want to do is pick a basis. But sometimes, if you're doing physics and there's something that is actually a very natural invariant property, then a basis, fixing some of the basis makes sense. And in particular, if we have completely positive trace-preserving maps, then there is a very privileged operator. That's the identity operator. And so it makes sense to include that in our basis. So we'll set B1 equal to 1 on the square root D times the identity, just for normalization. And then with that choice, the matrix representation takes on a slightly simpler form. So you can essentially regard this top row is telling you what happens if I plug in an identity operator. So note that B1 is equal to 1, 0, 0 there. So B1 will go to, well, the identity will go to the identity plus some other stuff. And this here is the unital block, which I call it that because if you have a unital channel, then you only have the one in this block, and this part is zero. But if you have a non-unital channel, such as an amplitude damping channel, then you have something non-trivial here. Now I'm going to define the unitarity to be the trace of EU dagger EU normalized. So that's essentially the normalized Frobenius norm of this unital block. So this quantity, which I've kind of plucked out of nowhere, essentially because I knew I could construct a protocol to get it, is the way I want to quantify the coherence of noise. And so now I'm going to show that, you know, I've magically managed to find something that actually contains useful information. Because we can sit here all day and come up with new parameters for noise. The trick is actually showing they're worth something. So this one is useful for two main reasons. It contains two important pieces of information related to the two ways of viewing the coherent versus stochastic noise issue. So the first is the unitarity captures how well you can improve your noise given perfect unitary control. So that tells you, so essentially, you know, if I can fiddle around with my pulse shape and timing, what fidelity can I get out? And the unitarity is going to tell you something, give you fairly good bounds on that. And then the second thing is, what's the diamond distance compared to the fidelity? And again, the unitarity is going to give you something that is going to be a constant factor of the diamond distance. So it's going to answer both of these questions quite well. So the first thing to do is to prove that it actually tells you something about whether you have the binary question of is it unitary or is it not unitary. So I'll just very quickly prove that. I shouldn't have put this up so high. Not yet. Okay. So proposition. So the unitarity is equal to 1 if and only if E is unitary. And it's unitarily invariant. So this second statement is essentially trivial, because if you just plug in extra unitaries here into this expression up here, you'll see that they all cancel if you use cyclic properties of the trace. So the key one is proving that it's 1 if and only if you have a unitary channel. And the proof of that is also fairly straightforward, modulo something I'll skip.
Is there an inverse missing or a star in the second line?
In for all.
Oh, that's a B and a U.
Sorry. So for all units, so if you apply unitaries, you don't change the unitarity. This will actually have some consequences to future work, but I won't get ahead of myself by too much there. So the proof, I'm actually going to skip a few steps, and you can prove that the norm of the non-unital vector is upper bounded by forget my dimensional factor. D minus 1 times 1 minus the unitarity of E. So the therefore the unitarity is one only if you have a unital channel. So this argument doesn't take long, but it's just more fiddly than I like to deal with on the board. And so we know that unitarity is one only if E is unital. If E is unital and CPTP, then E dagger E is a channel. Essentially, so E dagger is a channel if E is unital. And if E dagger E is a channel, well, then if I take if I compose it with itself multiple times, then that's a channel too. So by channel, I just mean short for completely positive trace preserving map. So for any positive integer z. And in particular, let's take the limit to infinity. We can say that the maximum...
E dagger in there is the same thing. I take the matrix representation of the E and I do the dagger on it?
Yes.
So suddenly there are elements at the top.
So that's why it's important that if the so it's only true if
E
is unital.
Also the end over there is zero.
Yeah. So if it's unital, we know E dagger is also a channel, and then we know that any power of it is a channel. Now E dagger E. So if I have E, I can use a singular value decomposition. This is non-negative and real. Real and non-negative. So E dagger E is just equal to V dagger sigma squared V. And if I take it to the nth power, I just get V dagger sigma to the 2m V. And if any of the elements of this are bigger than 1, of sigma are bigger than 1, this thing blows up. If any greater than 1, then E dagger E BM divergence. So we know that all of the diagonal elements are equal to one, at most 1, and then the unitarity is equal to the trace of sigma squared, and I should put in that these are unital blocks. And on d squared minus 1. So the only way I can get a unitarity equal to 1 is if sigma squared is equal to the identity. If every one of the, so there's d squared minus 1 diagonal elements, none of them are bigger than 1, so the sum can only be d squared minus 1 if all of them are 1. So sigma squared is the identity, which means that EU dagger EU is equal to V identity, or V dagger identity V, which is equal to the identity. So that implies that E inverse, is equal to d dagger, so that the unit or block is a unitary map, and I kind of skipped the proposition that shows, but that's kind of straightforward enough. So E is unitary. Okay, so it's one if and only if we have a unitary channel. What else can we do? Well, we can also quantify the optimal achievable fidelity using perfect control. I think I spent too long on the intro. Okay. Okay, so the second thing that makes it very useful is, actually let's define something first. Define E U sub V to be the channel where I first apply V, then my noise channel, and then U. So you can think of this as a noise channel that you're attempting to correct to apply some unitaries. And this has an associated infidelity, and the optimal fidelity you can achieve by correcting with unitaries is going to be just the minimum this quantity and we'd like to know, okay, what is this optimal achievable So given a fidelity and a unitarity, how well can we correct our system? How well can we correct our noise to try and get rid of it? And you can show using a few fairly elementary lines that the optimal fidelity is the best you can possibly do by correcting with unitary operations is directly proportional to 1 minus the square root of the unitarity. So if you have a unitary noise channel, this thing is 0, and that's kind of obvious. You can perfect to correct unitary channel. If this thing is a stochastic channel, then it tells you you can't improve any further. Once you know the fidelity and the unitarity. And the second half of this statement is only currently I only know how to prove it for qubits, for a single qubit. We know that you can get, that it's, you can't get better than 1 minus the square root of the unitarity. Now, I'm sure a lot of experimentalists would be thrilled if I told them, here's a lower bound on how well you can do, and this was several orders of magnitude off what they could actually do. You know, wasted a lot of effort trying to reach that bound when it was not possible in the first place, so we'd like an upper bound as well to say, you know, you can at least do this well. You may be able to do that well, or that this lower bound may be achievable, we don't know, but here's an upper bound that you can correct to. And for qubits, we have that. We know that you can actually get If you have a value of unitarity and you have a value, then you can get to within, you can achieve an infidelity of a half times one minus the unitarity. So again, this has the nice property that if you have unitary noise, it tells you you can do perfectly. If you have stochastic noise, it tells you you can't do much better. And it kind of characterizes the in-between regime. Now, the other thing that is, so this is telling you the control half. From the control perspective, unitarity is quantifying fairly precisely. And the gap here is significant but not immense. It's telling you how much you can improve your fidelity simply by improving your control. Now let's cover the other half of how big of an error do you actually get in terms of the diamond distance. And I mentioned earlier that I was presenting things in the reverse order. I'm actually cutting out the first things I did. So I'm actually up to the most recent thing I've done, which was establishing that both an upper and a lower bound for the diamond distance in terms of the infidelity and the unitarity. And the gap between the upper and lower bound is a factor of d squared. So if I define, I'm going to cheat for the moment and assume a unital. Basically, because the proof that things work for non-unital channels is straightforward enough, but a little ugly, and based off things that are nowhere near being published. So we'll just stick with the unital part for now. Then we know that we have upper and lower bounds. I'll just write down here. So we can do upper and lower bounds that actually differ by a factor of d for the worst case error in terms of this quantity here, where delta is the difference between my ideal channel, the identity, and the actual noisy channel, and j of delta is delta applied to one half of the maximally mixed state, so the Troy matrix.
Maximally entangled
state, not maximally mixed. Maximally entangled. And so if we could estimate this quantity here, this trace norm of the Troy matrix, then we would get a very precise or relatively precise estimate of the worst case error. And in order to try and do that, we can actually make use of some very simple inequalities. The biggest problem with trying to get this quantity, for me at least, is that the trace norm is hard to work with because it has trace of square root a dagger a. And if I want to change to the Frobenius norm, everything, my life gets a lot easier. And you can actually do that very easily. So this two norm now is just the square root of the trace of J delta dagger J delta. So essentially, these different SHAT and P norms you can think of as vector norms on the vector of singular values, and the vector 1 norm is always bigger than the vector 2 norm. And if I just use the Cauchy-Schwarz inequality, I can go from the 1 norm. The 2 norm is a factor of square root the number of elements times the 1 norm. So these are actually just simple vector norm inequalities. Here I've picked up a factor of d squared between the upper and lower bounds, which hurts a bit, but it's a lot better than square root infidelity scaling, particularly in the dimensions we're looking at the moment. So now the key is, instead of in turn trying to estimate the trace norm of J delta, which no one yet knows how to do, efficiently at least, the question is, now the only problem is to estimate this 2 norm, and it turns out almost magically that it is this quantity here. It's a function of the fidelity and the unitarity alone. This is actually an inequality, not an inequality. So if you have, just as a teaser for future work, if you have a non-unital channel, then you just add the length of the non-unital vector. So this ends up being an exact equality. And the key thing is, if you have a stochastic noise channel, so stochastic noise, so if I have a stochastic noise channel, then this quantity scales as order R squared. So this term here for stochastic noise actually completely cancels this first order contribution, which is quite nice to work out that actually worked in practice, which recovers the existing results that the worst case error scales as the order of, when you take the square root, it scales as the order of it scales as the order of the infidelity, the stochastic noise. But now this bound is actually going to, or when you plug this bound into these two expressions, that's actually going to hold no matter what type of noise channel you have. Once you have the unitarity and the infidelity, plug it in and you can get this nice both lower and upper bound, which for qubits will differ by a factor of 4. So you're no longer orders of magnitude off your worst case error, you're just a very small factor. And I think I'm out of time, so if anyone has questions, now's a good time.